Silent Spring, Disc 7.
How can uncoupling be brought about? Radiation is an uncoupler, and the death of cells exposed to radiation is thought by some to be brought about in this way. Unfortunately, a good many chemicals also have the power to separate oxidation from energy production, and the insecticides and weed killers are well represented on the list. The phenols, as we have seen, have a strong effect on metabolism, causing a potentially fatal rise in temperature. This is brought about by the racing engine effect of uncoupling. The dinitrophenols and pentachlorophenols are examples of this group that have widespread use as herbicides. Another uncoupler among the herbicides is 2,4-D. Of the chlorinated hydrocarbons, DDT is a proven uncoupler, and further study will probably reveal others among this group. But uncoupling is not the only way to extinguish the little fires in some or all of the body's billions of cells. We have seen that each step in oxidation is directed and expedited by a specific enzyme. When any of these enzymes, even a single one of them, is destroyed or weakened, the cycle of oxidation within the cell comes to a halt. It makes no difference which enzyme is affected. Oxidation progresses in a cycle like a turning wheel. If we thrust a crowbar between the spokes of a wheel, it makes no difference where we do it. The wheel stops turning. In the same way, if we destroy an enzyme that functions at any point in the cycle, oxidation ceases. There is then no further energy production. So the end effect is very similar to uncoupling. The crowbar to wreck the wheels of oxidation can be supplied by any number of chemicals commonly used as pesticides. DDT, methoxychlor, malathion, phenothiazine, and various dinitro compounds are among the numerous pesticides that have been found to inhibit one or more of the enzymes concerned in the cycle of oxidation. They thus appear as agents potentially capable of blocking the whole process of energy production and depriving the cells of utilizable oxygen. This is an injury with most disastrous consequences, only a few of which can be mentioned here. Merely by systematically withholding oxygen, experimenters have caused normal cells to turn into cancer cells, as we shall see in the following chapter. Some hint of other drastic consequences of depriving a cell of oxygen can be seen in animal experiments on developing embryos. With insufficient oxygen, the orderly processes by which the tissues unfold and the organs develop are disrupted. Malformations and other abnormalities then occur. Presumably, the human embryo deprived of oxygen may also develop congenital deformities. There are signs that an increase in such disasters is being noticed, even though few look far enough to find all of the causes. In one of the more unpleasant portents of the times, the Office of Vital Statistics in 1961 initiated a national tabulation of malformations at birth, with the explanatory comment that the resulting statistics would provide needed facts on the incidence of congenital malformations and the circumstances under which they occur. Such studies will no doubt be directed largely toward measuring the effects of radiation, but it must not be overlooked that many chemicals are the partners of radiation producing precisely the same effects. Some of the defects and malformations in tomorrow's children, grimly anticipated by the Office of Vital Statistics, will almost certainly be caused by these chemicals that permeate our outer and inner worlds. It may well be that some of the findings about diminished reproduction are also linked with interference with biological oxidation and consequent depletion of the all-important storage batteries of ATP. The egg, even before fertilization, needs to be generously supplied with ATP, ready and waiting for the enormous effort, the vast expenditure of energy that will be required once the sperm has entered and fertilization has occurred. Whether the sperm cell will reach and penetrate the egg depends upon its own supply of ATP, generated in the mitochondria thickly clustered in the neck of the cell. Once fertilization is accomplished and cell division has begun, the supply of energy in the form of ATP will largely determine whether the development of the embryo will proceed to completion. Embryologists studying some of their most convenient subjects, the eggs of frogs and of sea urchins, have found that if the ATP content is reduced below a certain critical level, the egg simply stops dividing and soon dies. It is not an impossible step from the embryology laboratory to the apple tree, where a robin's nest holds its complement of blue-green eggs. But the eggs lie cold, the fires of life that flickered for a few days now extinguished. Or to the top of a tall Florida pine, where a vast pile of twigs and sticks in ordered disorder holds three large white eggs, cold and lifeless. Why did the robins and the eaglets not hatch? Did the eggs of the birds, like those of the laboratory frogs, stop developing simply because they lacked enough of the common currency of energy, the ATP molecules, to complete their development? And was the lack of ATP brought about because in the body of the parent birds and in the eggs, there were stored enough insecticides to stop the little turning wheels of oxidation on which the supply of energy depends? It is no longer necessary to guess about the storage of insecticides in the eggs of birds, which obviously lend themselves to this kind of observation more readily than the mammalian ovum. Large residues of DDT and other hydrocarbons have been found whenever looked for in the eggs of birds subjected to these chemicals, either experimentally or in the wild. And the concentrations have been heavy. Pheasant eggs in a California experiment contained up to 349 parts per million of DDT. In Michigan, eggs taken from oviducts of robins dead of DDT poisoning showed concentrations up to 200 parts per million. Other eggs were taken from nests left unattended as parent robins were stricken with poison. These too contained DDT. Chickens poisoned by Aldrin, used on a neighboring farm, have passed on the chemical to their eggs. Hens experimentally fed DDT laid eggs containing as much as 65 parts per million. Knowing that DDT and other, perhaps all, chlorinated hydrocarbons stop the energy-producing cycle by inactivating a specific enzyme or uncoupling the energy-producing mechanism, it is hard to see how any egg so loaded with residues could complete the complex process of development. The infinite number of cell divisions, the elaboration of tissues and organs, the synthesis of vital substances that in the end produce a living creature. All of this requires vast amounts of energy. The little packets of ATP which the turning of the metabolic wheel alone can produce. There is no reason to suppose that these disastrous events are confined to birds. ATP is the universal currency of energy, and the metabolic cycles that produce it turn to the same purpose in birds and bacteria, in men and mice. The fact of insecticide storage in the germ cells of any species should therefore disturb us, suggesting comparable effects in human beings. And there are indications that these chemicals lodge in tissues concerned with the manufacture of germ cells as well as in the cells themselves. Accumulations of insecticides have been discovered in the sex organs of a variety of birds and mammals, in pheasants, mice, and guinea pigs under controlled conditions, in robins in an area sprayed for elm disease, and in deer roaming western forests sprayed for spruce budworm. In one of the robins, the concentration of DDT in the testes was heavier than in any other part of the body. Pheasants also accumulated extraordinary amounts in the testes, up to 1,500 parts per million. Probably as an effect of storage in the sex organs, atrophy of the testes has been observed in experimental mammals. Young rats exposed to methoxychlor had extraordinarily small testes. When young roosters were fed DDT, the testes made only 18% of their normal growth. Combs and wattles, dependent for their development upon the testicular hormone, were only a third the normal size. The spermatozoa themselves may well be affected by loss of ATP. Experiments show that the motility of bull sperm is decreased by dinitrophenol, which interferes with the energy coupling mechanism with inevitable loss of energy. The same effect would probably be found with other chemicals were the matter investigated. Some indication of the possible effect on human beings is seen in medical reports of oligospermia, or reduced production of spermatozoa among aviation crop dusters applying DDT. For mankind as a whole, a possession infinitely more valuable than individual life is our genetic heritage, our link with past and future. Shaped through long eons of evolution, our genes not only make us what we are, but hold in their minute beings the future, be it one of promise or threat. Yet genetic deterioration through man-made agents is the menace of our time, the last and greatest danger to our civilization. Again, the parallel between chemicals and radiation is exact and inescapable. The living cell assaulted by radiation suffers a variety of injuries. Its ability to divide normally may be destroyed, it may suffer changes in chromosome structure, or the genes, carriers of hereditary material, may undergo those sudden changes known as mutations, which cause them to produce new characteristics in succeeding generations. If especially susceptible, the cell may be killed outright, or finally, after the passage of time, measured in years, it may become malignant. All these consequences of radiation have been duplicated in laboratory studies by a large group of chemicals known as radiomimetic or radiation imitating. Many chemicals used as pesticides, herbicides, as well as insecticides, belong to this group of substances that have the ability to damage the chromosomes, interfere with normal cell division, or cause mutations. These injuries to the genetic material are of a kind that may lead to disease in the individual exposed, or they may make their effects felt in future generations. Only a few decades ago, no one knew these effects of either radiation or chemicals. In those days, the atom had not been split, and few of the chemicals that were to duplicate radiation had as yet been conceived in the test tubes of chemists. Then in 1927, a professor of zoology in a Texas university, Dr. H. J. Muller, found that by exposing an organism to X radiation, he could produce mutations in succeeding generations. With Muller's discovery, a vast new field of scientific and medical knowledge was opened up. Muller later received the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his achievement, and in a world that soon gained unhappy familiarity with the gray rains of fallout, even the non-scientist now knows the potential results of radiation. Although far less noticed, a companion discovery was made by Charlotte Auerbach and William Robson at the University of Edinburgh in the early 1940s. Working with mustard gas, they found that this chemical produces permanent chromosome abnormalities that cannot be distinguished from those induced by radiation. Tested on the fruit fly, the same organism Muller had used in his original work with X-rays, mustard gas also produced mutations. Thus, the first chemical mutagen was discovered. Mustard gas, as a mutagen, has now been joined by a long list of other chemicals known to alter genetic material in plants and animals. To understand how chemicals can alter the course of heredity, we must first watch the basic drama of life as it is played out on the stage of the living cell. The cells, composing the tissues and organs of the body, must have the power to increase in number if the body is to grow and if the stream of life is to be kept flowing from generation to generation. This is accomplished by the process of mitosis, or nuclear division, In a cell that is about to divide, changes of the utmost importance occur. First within the nucleus, but eventually involving the entire cell. Within the nucleus, the chromosomes mysteriously move and divide, ranging themselves in age-old patterns that will serve to distribute the determiners of heredity, the genes, to the daughter cells. First, they assume the form of elongated threads on which the genes are aligned, like beads on a string. Then, each chromosome divides lengthwise, the genes dividing also. When the cell divides in two, half of each goes to each of the daughter cells. In this way, each new cell will contain a complete set of chromosomes and all the genetic information encoded within them. In this way, the integrity of the race and of the species is preserved. In this way, like begets like. A special kind of cell division occurs in the formation of the germ cells. Because the chromosome number for a given species is constant, the egg and the sperm, which are to unite to form a new individual, must carry to their union only half the species number. This is accomplished with extraordinary precision by a change in the behavior of the chromosomes that occurs at one of the divisions producing those cells. At this time, the chromosomes do not split, but one whole chromosome of each pair goes into each daughter cell. In this elemental drama, all life is revealed as one. The events of the process of cell division are common to all earthly life. Neither man nor amoeba, the giant sequoia, nor the simple yeast cell can long exist without carrying on this process of cell division. Anything that disturbs mitosis is therefore a grave threat to the welfare of the organism affected and to its descendants. The major features of cellular organization, including, for instance, mitosis, must be much older than 500 million years, more nearly 1,000 million, wrote George Gaylord Simpson and his colleagues Pittendry and Tiffany in their broadly encompassing book entitled Life. In this sense, the world of life, while surely fragile and complex, is incredibly durable through time, more durable than mountains. This durability is wholly dependent on the almost incredible accuracy with which the inherited information is copied from generation to generation. But in all the 1,000 million years envisioned by these authors, no threat has struck so directly and so forcefully at that incredible accuracy as the mid-20th century threat of man-made radiation and man-made and man-disseminated chemicals. Sir MacFarlane Burnet, a distinguished Australian physician and Nobel Prize winner, considers it one of the most significant medical features of our time, that as a byproduct of more and more powerful therapeutic procedures and the production of chemical substances outside of biological experiences, the normal protective barriers that kept mutagenic agents from the internal organs have been more and more frequently penetrated. The study of human chromosomes is in its infancy, and so it has only recently become possible to study the effect of environmental factors upon them. It was not until 1956 that new techniques made it possible to determine accurately the number of chromosomes in the human cell, 46, and to observe them in such detail that the presence or absence of whole chromosomes or even parts of chromosomes could be detected. The whole concept of genetic damage by something in the environment is also relatively new and is little understood except by the geneticists, whose advice is too seldom sought. The hazard from radiation in its various forms is now reasonably well understood, although still denied in surprising places. Dr. Muller has frequently had occasion to deplore the resistance to the acceptance of genetic principles on the part of so many, not only of governmental appointees in the policy-making positions, but also of so many of the medical profession. The fact that chemicals may play a role similar to radiation has scarcely dawned on the public mind, nor on the minds of most medical or scientific workers. For this reason, the role of chemicals in general use, rather than in laboratory experiments, hasn't yet been assessed. It is extremely important that this be done. Sir McFarlane is not alone in his estimate of the potential danger. Dr. Peter Alexander, an outstanding British authority, has said that the radiomimetic chemicals may well represent a greater danger than radiation. Dr. Muller, with the perspective gained by decades of distinguished work in genetics, warns that various chemicals, including groups represented by pesticides, can raise the mutation frequency as much as radiation. As yet, far too little is known of the extent to which our genes, under modern conditions of exposure to unusual chemicals, are being subjected to such mutagenic influences. The widespread neglect of the problem of chemical mutagens is perhaps due to the fact that those first discovered were of scientific interest only. Nitrogen mustard, after all, is not sprayed upon whole populations from the air. Its use is in the hands of experimental biologists or of physicians who use it in cancer therapy. A case of chromosome damage in a patient receiving such therapy has recently been reported. But insecticides and weed killers are brought into intimate contact with large numbers of people. Despite the scant attention that has been given to the matter, it is possible to assemble specific information on a number of these pesticides, showing that they disturb the cell's vital processes in ways ranging from slight chromosome damage to gene mutation, and with consequences extending to the ultimate disaster of malignancy. Mosquitoes, exposed to DDT for several generations, turned into strange creatures called gyandromorphs, part male and part female. Plants treated with various phenols suffered profound destruction of chromosomes, changes in genes, a striking number of mutations, irreversible hereditary changes. Mutations also occurred in fruit flies, the classic subject of genetics experiments when subjected to phenol. These flies develop mutations so damaging as to be fatal on exposure to one of the common herbicides or to urethane. Urethane belongs to the group of chemicals called carbamates, from which an increasing number of insecticides and other agricultural chemicals are drawn. Two of the carbamates are actually used to prevent sprouting of potatoes in storage, precisely because of their proven effect in stopping cell division. Another anti-sprouting agent, maleic hydrazide, is rated a powerful mutagen. Plants treated with benzene hexachloride, BHC, or lindane became monstrously deformed with tumor-like swellings on their roots. Their cells grew in size, being swollen with chromosomes which doubled in number. The doubling continued in future divisions until further cell division became mechanically impossible. The herbicide 2,4-D has also produced tumor-like swellings in treated plants. Chromosomes become short, thick, clumped together. Cell division is seriously retarded. The general effect is said to parallel closely that produced by X-rays. These are but a few illustrations. Many more could be cited. As yet, there has been no comprehensive study aimed at testing the mutagenic effects of pesticides as such. The facts cited above are byproducts of research in cell physiology or genetics. What is urgently needed is a direct attack on the problem. Some scientists who are willing to concede the potent effect of environmental radiation on man nevertheless question whether mutagenic chemicals can, as a practical proposition, have the same effect. They cite the great penetrating power of radiation, but doubt that chemicals could reach the germ cells. Once again, we are hampered by the fact that there has been little direct investigation of the problem in man. However, the findings of large residues of DDT in the gonads and germ cells of birds and mammals is strong evidence that the chlorinated hydrocarbons, at least, not only become widely distributed throughout the body, but come into contact with genetic materials. Professor David E. Davis at Pennsylvania State University has recently discovered that a potent chemical which prevents cells from dividing and has had limited use in cancer therapy can also be used to cause sterility in birds. Sublethal levels of the chemical halt cell division in the gonads. Professor Davis has had some success in field trials. Obviously, then, there is little basis for the hope or belief that the gonads of any organism are shielded from chemicals in the environment. Recent medical findings in the field of chromosome abnormalities are of extreme interest and significance. In 1959, several British and French research teams found their independent studies pointing to a common conclusion, that some of humanity's ills are caused by a disturbance of the normal chromosome number. In certain diseases and abnormalities studied by these investigators, the number differed from the normal. To illustrate, it is now known that all typical mongoloids have one extra chromosome. Occasionally, this is attached to another so that the chromosome number remains the normal 46. As a rule, however, the extra is a separate chromosome, making the number 47. In such individuals, the original cause of the defect must have occurred in the generation preceding its appearance. A different mechanism seems to operate in a number of patients both in America and Great Britain who are suffering from a chronic form of leukemia. These have been found to have a consistent chromosome abnormality in some of the blood cells. The abnormality consists of the loss of part of a chromosome. In these patients, the skin cells have a normal complement of chromosomes. This indicates that the chromosome defect did not occur in the germ cells that gave rise to these individuals, but represents damage to particular cells, in this case, the precursors of blood cells, that occurred during the life of the individual. The loss of part of a chromosome has perhaps deprived these cells of their instructions for normal behavior. The list of defects linked to chromosome disturbances has grown with surprising speed since the opening of this territory, hitherto beyond the boundaries of medical research. One known only as Klinefelter syndrome involves a duplication of one of the sex chromosomes. The resulting individual is a male, but because he carries two of the X chromosome, becoming XXY instead of XY, the normal male complement, he is somewhat abnormal. Excessive height and mental defects often accompany the sterility caused by this condition. In contrast, an individual who receives only one sex chromosome, becoming XO instead of XX or XY, is actually female, but lacks many of the secondary sexual characteristics. The condition is accompanied by various physical and sometimes mental defects. For of course, the X chromosome carries genes for a variety of characteristics. This is known as Turner syndrome. Both conditions had been described in medical literature long before the cause was known. An immense amount of work on the subject of chromosome abnormalities is being done by workers in many countries. A group at the University of Wisconsin, headed by Dr. Klaus Patau, has been concentrating on a variety of congenital abnormalities, usually including mental retardation, that seem to result from the duplication of only part of a chromosome, as if somewhere in the formation of one of the germ cells, a chromosome had broken and the pieces had not been properly redistributed. Such a mishap is likely to interfere with the normal development of the embryo. According to present knowledge, the occurrence of an entire extra body chromosome is usually lethal, preventing survival of the embryo. Only three such conditions are known to be viable. One of them, of course, is mongolism. The presence of an extra attached fragment, on the other hand, although seriously damaging, is not necessarily fatal. And according to the Wisconsin investigators, this situation may well account for a substantial part of the so far unexplained cases in which a child is born with multiple defects, usually including mental retardation. This is so new a field of study that as yet scientists have been more concerned with identifying the chromosome abnormalities associated with disease and defective development than with speculating about the causes. It would be foolish to assume that any single agent is responsible for damaging the chromosomes or causing their erratic behavior during cell division. But can we afford to ignore the fact that we are now filling the environment with chemicals that have the power to strike directly at the chromosomes, affecting them in the precise ways that could cause such conditions? Is this not too high a price to pay for a sproutless potato or a mosquito-less patio? We can, if we wish, reduce this threat to our genetic heritage, a possession that has come down to us through some 2 billion years of evolution and selection of living protoplasm, a possession that is ours for the moment only, until we must pass it on to generations to come. We're doing little now to preserve its integrity. Although chemical manufacturers are required by law to test the materials for toxicity, they are not required to make the tests that would reliably demonstrate genetic effect. And they do not do so. Chapter 14, One in Every Four. The battle of living things against cancer began so long ago that its origin is lost in time. But it must have begun in a natural environment in which whatever life inhabited the earth was subjected, for good or ill, to influences that had their origin in sun and storm and the ancient nature of the earth. Some of the elements of this environment created hazards to which life had to adjust or perish. The ultraviolet radiation in sunlight could cause malignancy. So could radiations from certain rocks, or arsenic washed out of soil or rocks to contaminate food or water supplies. The environment contained these hostile elements even before there was life. Yet life arose, and over millions of years it came to exist in infinite numbers and endless variety. Over the eons of unhurried time that is nature's, life reached an adjustment with destructive forces as selection weeded out the less adaptable and only the most resistant survived. These natural cancer-causing agents are still a factor in producing malignancy. However, they are few in number and they belong to that ancient array of forces to which life has become accustomed from the beginning. With the advent of man, the situation began to change. For man alone, of all forms of life, can create cancer-producing substances, which in medical terminology are called carcinogens. A few man-made carcinogens have been part of the environment for centuries. An example is soot, containing aromatic hydrocarbons. With the dawn of the industrial era, the world became a place of continuous, ever-accelerating change. Instead of the natural environment, there was rapidly substituted an artificial one composed of new chemical and physical agents, many of them possessing powerful capacities for inducing biologic change. Against these carcinogens, which his own activities had created, man had no protection. For even as his biological heritage has evolved slowly, so it adapts slowly to new conditions. As a result, these powerful substances could easily penetrate the inadequate defenses of the body. The history of cancer is long, but our recognition of the agents that produce it has been slow to mature. The first awareness that external or environmental agents could produce a malignant change dawned in the mind of a London physician nearly 2 centuries ago. In 1775, Sir Percival Pott declared that the scrotal cancer, so common among chimney sweeps, must be caused by the soot that accumulated on their bodies. He could not furnish the proof we would demand today, But modern research methods have now isolated the deadly chemical in soot and proved the correctness of his perception. For a century or more after Pott's discovery, there seems to have been little further realization that certain of the chemicals in the human environment could cause cancer by repeated skin contact, inhalation, or swallowing. True, it had been noticed that skin cancer was prevalent among workers exposed to arsenic fumes in copper smelters and tin foundries in Cornwall and Wales. And it was realized that workers in the cobalt mines in Saxony and in the uranium mines in Joachimstal in Bohemia were subject to a disease of the lungs, later identified as cancer. But these were phenomena of the pre-industrial era, before the flowering of the industries whose products were to pervade the environment of almost every living thing. The first recognition of malignancies traceable to the age of industry came during the last quarter of the 19th century. About the time that Pasteur was demonstrating the microbial origin of many infectious diseases, others were discovering the chemical origin of cancer. Skin cancers among workers in the new lignite industry in Saxony and in the Scottish shale industry, along with other cancers caused by occupational exposure to tar and pitch. By the end of the 19th century, a half dozen sources of industrial carcinogens were known. The 20th century was to create countless new cancer-causing chemicals and to bring the general population into intimate contact with them. In the less than two centuries intervening since the work of Pott, the environmental situation has been vastly changed. No longer are exposures to dangerous chemicals occupational alone. They have entered the environment of everyone, even of children as yet unborn. It is hardly surprising, therefore, that we are now aware of the alarming increase in malignant disease. The increase itself is no mere matter of subjective impressions. The monthly report of the Office of Vital Statistics for July 1959 states that malignant growths, including those of the lymphatic and blood-forming tissues, accounted for 15% of the deaths in 1958, compared with only 4% in 1900. Judging by the present incidence of the disease, the American Cancer Society estimates that 45 million Americans now living will eventually develop cancer. This means that malignant disease will strike 2 out of 3 families. The situation with respect to children is even more deeply disturbing. A quarter century ago, cancer in children was considered a medical rarity. Today, more American school children die of cancer than from any other disease. So serious has the situation become that Boston has established the first hospital in the United States devoted exclusively to the treatment of children with cancer. 12% of all deaths in children between the ages of 1 and 14 are caused by cancer. Large numbers of malignant tumors are discovered clinically in children under the age of 5. But it is an even grimmer fact that significant numbers of such growths are present at or before birth. Dr. W.C. Huper of the National Cancer Institute, a foremost authority on environmental cancer, has suggested that congenital cancers and cancers in infants may be related to the action of cancer-producing agents to which the mother has been exposed during pregnancy, and which penetrate the placenta to act on the rapidly developing fetal tissues. Experiments show that the younger the animal is when it is subjected to a cancer-producing agent, the more certain is the production of cancer. Dr. Francis Ray of the University of Florida has warned that we may be initiating cancer in the children of today by the addition of chemicals to food. We will not know, perhaps for a generation or two, what the effects will be. The problem that concerns us here is whether any of the chemicals we are using in our attempts to control nature play a direct or indirect role as causes of cancer. In terms of evidence gained from animal experiments, we shall see that 5 or possibly 6 of the pesticides must definitely be rated as carcinogens. The list is greatly lengthened if we add those considered by some physicians to cause leukemia in human patients. Here the evidence is circumstantial, as it must be, since we do not experiment on human beings, but it is nonetheless impressive. Still, other pesticides will be added as we include those whose action on living tissues or cells may be considered an indirect cause of malignancy. One of the earliest pesticides associated with cancer is arsenic, occurring in sodium arsenite as a weed killer and in calcium arsenate and various other compounds as insecticides. The association between arsenic and cancer in man and animals is historic. A fascinating example of the consequences of exposure to arsenic is related by Dr. Huper in his Occupational Tumors, a classic monograph on the subject. The city of Reichenstein in Silesia had been for almost 1,000 years the site of mining for gold and silver ores, and for several hundred years for arsenic ores. Over the centuries, arsenic wastes accumulated in the vicinity of the mine shafts and were picked up by streams coming down from the mountains. The underground water also became contaminated, and arsenic entered the drinking water. For centuries, many of the inhabitants of this region suffered from what came to be known as Reichenstein disease. Chronic arsenicism, with accompanying disorders of the liver, skin, and gastrointestinal and nervous systems. Malignant tumors were a common accompaniment of the disease. Reichenstein's disease is now chiefly of historic interest, for new water supplies were provided a quarter of a century ago from which arsenic was largely eliminated. In Cordoba province in Argentina, however, chronic arsenic poisoning accompanied by arsenical skin cancers is endemic because of the contamination of drinking water derived from rock formations containing arsenic. It would not be difficult to create conditions similar to those in Reichenstein in Cordoba by long-continued use of arsenical insecticides. In the United States, the arsenic-drenched soils of tobacco plantations, of many orchards in the northwest, and blueberry lands in the east may easily lead to pollution of water supplies. An arsenic-contaminated environment affects not only man, but animals as well. A report of great interest came from Germany in 1936. In the area about Freiburg, Saxony, smelters for silver and lead poured arsenic fumes into the air to drift out over the surrounding countryside and settle down upon the vegetation. According to Dr. Huper, horses, cows, goats, and pigs, which of course fed on this vegetation, showed loss of hair and thickening of the skin. Deer inhabiting nearby forests sometimes had abnormal pigment spots and precancerous warts. One had a definitely cancerous lesion. Both domestic and wild animals were affected by arsenical enteritis, gastric ulcers, and cirrhosis of the liver. Sheep kept near the smelters developed cancers of the nasal sinus. At their death, arsenic was found in the brain, liver, and tumors. In the area, there was also an extraordinary mortality among insects, especially bees. After rainfalls, which washed the arsenical dust from the leaves and carried it along into the water of brooks and pools, a great many fish died. An example of a carcinogen belonging to the group of new organic pesticides is a chemical widely used against mites and ticks. Its history provides abundant proof that despite the supposed safeguards provided by legislation, the public can be exposed to a known carcinogen for several years before the slowly moving legal processes can bring the situation under control. The story is interesting from another standpoint, proving that what the public is asked to accept as safe today may turn out tomorrow to be extremely dangerous. When this chemical was introduced in 1955, the manufacturer applied for a tolerance which would sanction the presence of small residues on any crops that might be sprayed. As required by law, he had tested the chemical on laboratory animals and submitted the results with his application. However, scientists of the Food and Drug Administration interpreted the tests as showing a possible cancer-producing tendency, and the commissioner accordingly recommended a zero tolerance, which is a way of saying that no residues could legally occur on food shipped across state lines. But the manufacturer had the legal right to appeal, and the case was accordingly reviewed by a committee. The committee's decision was a compromise. A tolerance of one part per million was to be established, and the product marketed for 2 years, during which time further laboratory tests were to determine whether the chemical was actually a carcinogen. Although the committee didn't say so, its decision meant that the public was to act as guinea pigs, testing the suspected carcinogen along with the laboratory dogs and rats. But laboratory animals give more prompt results, and after the 2 years it was evident that this miticide was indeed a carcinogen. Even at that point, in 1957, the Food and Drug Administration could not instantly rescind the tolerance which allowed residues of a known carcinogen to contaminate food consumed by the public. Another year was required for various legal procedures. Finally, in December 1958, the zero tolerance, which the commissioner had recommended in 1955, became effective. These are by no means the only known carcinogens among pesticides. In laboratory tests on animal subjects, DDT has produced suspicious liver tumors. Scientists of the Food and Drug Administration who reported the discovery of these tumors were uncertain how to classify them, but felt there was some justification for considering them low-grade hepatic cell carcinomas. Dr. Huper now gives DDT the definite rating of a chemical carcinogen. Two herbicides belonging to the carbamate group, IPC and CIPC, have been found to play a role in producing skin tumors in mice. Some of the tumors are malignant. These chemicals seem to initiate the malignant change, which may then be completed by other chemicals of types prevalent in the environment. The weed killer, aminotriazole, has caused thyroid cancer in test animals. This chemical was misused by a number of cranberry growers in 1959, producing residues on some of the marketed berries. In the controversy that followed seizure of the contaminated cranberries by the Food and Drug Administration, the fact that the chemical actually is cancer-producing was widely challenged, even by many medical men. The scientific facts released by the Food and Drug Administration clearly indicate the carcinogenic nature of aminotriazole in laboratory rats. When these animals were fed this chemical at the rate of 100 parts per million in the drinking water, or 1 teaspoonful of chemical in 10,000 teaspoonfuls of water, they began to develop thyroid tumors at the 68th week. After 2 years, such tumors were present in more than half of the rats examined. They were diagnosed as various types of benign and malignant growths. The tumors also appeared at lower levels of feeding. In fact, a level that produced no effect was not found. No one knows, of course, the level at which aminotriazole may be carcinogenic for man. But as a professor of medicine at Harvard University, Dr. David Rutstein had pointed out, the level is just as likely to be to man's disfavor as to his advantage. As yet, insufficient time has elapsed to reveal the full effect of the new chlorinated hydrocarbon insecticides and of the modern herbicides. Most malignancies develop so slowly that they may require a considerable segment of the victim's life to reach the stage of showing clinical symptoms. In the early 1920s, women who painted luminous figures on watch dials swallowed minute amounts of radium by touching the brushes to their lips. In some of these women, bone cancers developed after a lapse of 15 or more years. A period of 15 to 30 years, or even more, has been demonstrated for some cancers caused by occupational exposures to chemical carcinogens. In contrast to these industrial exposures to various carcinogens, The first exposures to DDT date from about 1942 for military personnel and from about 1945 for civilians. And it was not until the early 50s that a wide variety of pesticidal chemicals came into use. The full maturing of whatever seeds of malignancy have been sown by these chemicals is yet to come. There is, however, one presently known exception to the fact that a long period of latency is common to most malignancies. This exception is leukemia. Survivors of Hiroshima began to develop leukemia only 3 years after the atomic bombing, and there is now reason to believe the latent period may be considerably shorter. Other types of cancer may in time be found to have a relatively short latent period also, but at present, leukemia seems to be the exception to the general rule of extremely slow development. Within the period covered by the rise of modern pesticides, the incidence of leukemia has been steadily rising. Figures available from the National Office of Vital Statistics clearly establish a disturbing rise in malignant diseases of the blood-forming tissues. In the year 1960, leukemia alone claimed 12,290 victims. Deaths from all types of malignancies of blood and lymph totaled 25,400, increasing sharply from the 16,690 figure of 1950. In terms of deaths per 100,000 of population, the increase is from 11.1 in 1950 to 14.1 in 1960. The increase is by no means confined to the United States. In all countries, the recorded deaths from leukemia at all ages are rising at a rate of 4 to 5% a year. What does it mean? To what lethal agent or agents new to our environment are people now exposed with increasing frequency? Such world-famous institutions as the Mayo Clinic admit hundreds of victims of these diseases of the blood-forming organs. Dr. Malcolm Hargraves and his associates in the hematology department at the Mayo Clinic report that almost without exception, these patients have had a history of exposure to various toxic chemicals, including sprays which contain DDT, chlordane, benzene, lindane, and petroleum distillates. Environmental diseases related to the use of various toxic substances have been increasing, particularly during the past 10 years, Dr. Hargraves believes. From extensive clinical experience, he believes that the vast majority of patients suffering from the blood dyscrasias and lymphoid diseases have a significant history of exposure to the various hydrocarbons, which in turn includes most of the pesticides of today. A careful medical history will almost invariably establish such a relationship. This specialist now has a large number of detailed case histories based on every patient he has seen with leukemias, aplastic anemias, Hodgkin's disease, and other disorders of the blood and blood-forming tissue. They had all been exposed to these environmental agents with a fair amount of exposure, he reports. What do these case histories show? One concerned a housewife who abhorred spiders. In mid-August, she had gone into her basement with an aerosol spray containing DDT and petroleum distillate. She sprayed the entire basement thoroughly, under the stairs, in the fruit cupboards, and in all the protected areas around ceiling and rafters. As she finished the spraying, she began to feel quite ill, with nausea and extreme anxiety and nervousness. Within the next few days, she felt better, however, and apparently not suspecting the cause of her difficulty, she repeated the entire procedure in September, running through 2 more cycles of spraying, falling ill, recovering temporarily, spraying again. After the 3rd use of the aerosol, new symptoms developed: fever, pains in the joints and general malaise, acute phlebitis in 1 leg. When examined by Dr. Hargraves, she was found to be suffering from acute leukemia. She died within the following month. Another of Dr. Hargraves' patients was a professional man who had his office in an old building infested by roaches. Becoming embarrassed by the presence of these insects, he took control measures in his own hands. He spent most of one Sunday spraying the basement and all secluded areas. The spray was a 25% DDT concentrate suspended in a solvent containing methylated naphthalenes. Within a short time, he began to bruise and bleed. He entered the clinic bleeding from a number of hemorrhages. Studies of his blood revealed a severe depression of the bone marrow called aplastic anemia. During the next 5.5 months, he received 59 transfusions in addition to other therapy. There was partial recovery, but about 9 years later, a fatal leukemia developed. Where pesticides are involved, the chemicals that figure most prominently in the case histories are DDT, lindane, benzene hexachloride, the nitrophenols, the common moth crystal, paradichlorobenzene, chlordane, and of course, the solvents in which they are carried. As this physician emphasizes, pure exposure to a single chemical is the exception rather than the rule. The commercial product usually contains combinations of several chemicals suspended in a petroleum distillate plus some dispersing agent. The aromatic cyclic and unsaturated hydrocarbons of the vehicle may themselves be a major factor in the damage done to the blood-forming organs. From the practical rather than the medical standpoint, this distinction is of little importance, however, because these petroleum solvents are an inseparable part of most common spraying practices. The medical literature of this and other countries contains many significant cases that support Dr. Hargrave's belief in a cause and effect relation between these chemicals and leukemia and other blood disorders. They concern such everyday people as farmers caught in the fallout of their own spray rigs or of planes, a college student who sprayed his study for ants and remained in the room to study, a woman who had installed a portable lindane vaporizer in her home, a worker in a cotton field that had been sprayed with chlordane and toxaphene. They carry, half-concealed within their medical terminology, stories of such human tragedies as that of two young cousins in Czechoslovakia, boys who lived in the same town and had always worked and played together. Their last and most fateful employment was at a farm cooperative, where it was their job to unload sacks of an insecticide, benzene hexachloride. 8 months later, one of the boys was stricken with acute leukemia. In 9 days, he was dead. At about this time, his cousin began to tire easily and to run a temperature. Within about 3 months, his symptoms became more severe, and he too was hospitalized. Again, the diagnosis was acute leukemia, and again the disease ran its inevitably fatal course. And then there is the case of a Swedish farmer, strangely reminiscent of that of the Japanese fisherman Kubuyama of the tuna vessel, the Lucky Dragon. Like Kubuyama, the farmer had been a healthy man, gleaning his living from the land as Kubuyama had taken his from the sea. For each man, a poison drifting out of the sky carried a death sentence. For one, it was radiation-poisoned ash. For the other, chemical dust. The farmer had treated about 60 acres of land with a dust containing DDT and benzene hexachloride. As he worked, puffs of wind brought little clouds of dust swirling about him. In the evening, he felt unusually tired, and during subsequent days, he had a general feeling of weakness, with backache and aching legs, as well as chills, and was obliged to take to his bed, says a report from the medical clinic at Lund. His condition became worse, however, and on May 19th, a week after the spraying, he applied for admission to the local hospital. He had a high fever and his blood count was abnormal. He was transferred to the medical clinic, where after an illness of 2.5 months, he died. A post-mortem examination revealed a complete wasting away of the bone marrow. How a normal and necessary process such as cell division can become altered so that it is alien and destructive is a problem that has engaged the attention of countless scientists and untold sums of money. What happens in a cell to change its orderly multiplication into the wild and uncontrolled proliferation of cancer? When answers are found, they will almost certainly be multiple. just as cancer itself is a disease that wears many guises, appearing in various forms that differ in their origin, in the course of their development, and in the factors that influence their growth or regression, so there must be a corresponding variety of causes. Yet underlying them all, perhaps only a few basic kinds of injuries to the cell are responsible. Here and there in research, widely scattered, and sometimes not undertaken as a cancer study at all, we see glimmerings of the first light that may one day illuminate this problem. Again, we find that only by looking at some of the smallest units of life, the cell and its chromosomes, can we find that wider vision needed to penetrate such mysteries. Here in this microcosm, we must look for those factors that somehow shift the marvelously functioning mechanisms of the cell out of their normal patterns. One of the most impressive theories of the origin of cancer cells was developed by a German biochemist, Professor Otto Warburg of the Max Planck Institute of Cell Physiology. Warburg has devoted a lifetime of study to the complex processes of oxidation within the cell. Out of this broad background of understanding came a fascinating and lucid explanation of the way a normal cell can become malignant. Warburg believes that either radiation or a chemical carcinogen acts by destroying the respiration of normal cells, thus depriving them of energy. This action may result from minute doses, often repeated. The effect, once achieved, is irreversible. The cells not killed outright by the impact of such a respiratory poison struggle to compensate for the loss of energy. They can no longer carry on that extraordinary and efficient cycle by which vast amounts of ATP are produced, but are thrown back on a primitive and far less efficient method, that of fermentation. The struggle to survive by fermentation continues for a long period of time. It continues through ensuing cell divisions so that all the descendant cells have this abnormal method of respiration. Once a cell has lost its normal respiration, it cannot regain it, not in a year, not in a decade, or in many decades. But little by little, in this grueling struggle to restore lost energy, those cells that survive begin to compensate by increased fermentation. It is a Darwinian struggle in which only the most fit or adaptable survive. At last they reach the point where fermentation is able to produce as much energy as respiration. At this point, cancer cells may be said to have been created from normal body cells. Warburg's theory explains many otherwise puzzling things. The long latent period of most cancers is the time required for the infinite number of cell divisions during which fermentation is gradually increasing after the initial damage to respiration. The time required for fermentation to become dominant varies in different species because of different fermentation rates. A short time in the rat, in which cancers appear quickly, a long time, decades even, in man, in whom the development of malignancy is a deliberate process. The Warburg theory also explains why repeated small doses of a carcinogen are more dangerous under some circumstances than a single large dose. The latter may kill the cells outright, whereas the small doses allow some to survive, though in a damaged condition. These survivors may then develop into cancer cells. This is why there is no safe dose of carcinogen. In Warburg's theory, we also find explanation of an otherwise incomprehensible fact, that one and the same agent can be useful in treating cancer and can also cause it. This, as everyone knows, is true of radiation, which kills cancer cells but may also cause cancer. It is also true of many of the chemicals now used against cancer. Why? Both types of agents damage respiration. Cancer cells already have a defective respiration, so with additional damage, they die. The normal cells suffering respiratory damage for the first time are not killed, but are set on the path that may eventually lead to malignancy. Warburg's ideas received confirmation in 1953, when other workers were able to turn normal cells into cancer cells merely by depriving them of oxygen intermittently over long periods. Then in 1961, other confirmation came, this time from living animals rather than tissue cultures. Radioactive tracer substances were injected into cancerous mice. Then by careful measurements of their respiration, it was found that the fermentation rate was markedly above normal, just as Warburg had foreseen. Measured by the standards established by Warburg, most pesticides meet the criterion of the perfect carcinogen too well for comfort. As we've seen in the preceding chapter, many of the chlorinated hydrocarbons, the phenols, and some herbicides interfere with oxidation and energy production within the cell. By these means, they may be creating sleeping cancer cells, cells in which an irreversible malignancy will slumber long and undetected until finally, its cause long forgotten and even unsuspected, it flares into the open as recognizable cancer. Another path to cancer may be by way of the chromosomes. Many of the most distinguished research men in this field look with suspicion on any agent that damages the chromosomes, interferes with cell division, or causes mutations. In the view of these men, any mutation is a potential cause of cancer. Although discussions of mutations usually refer to those in the germ cells, which may then make their effect felt in future generations, there may also be mutations in the body cells. According to the mutation theory of the origin of cancer, a cell, perhaps under the influence of radiation or of a chemical, develops a mutation that allows it to escape the controls the body normally asserts over cell division. It is therefore able to multiply in a wild and unregulated manner. The new cells resulting from these divisions have the same ability to escape control, and in time, enough such cells have accumulated to constitute a cancer. Other investigators point to the fact that the chromosomes in cancer tissue are unstable. They tend to be broken or damaged. The number may be erratic. There may even be double sets. The first investigators to trace chromosome abnormalities all the way to actual malignancy were Albert Levin and John J. Beazle, working at the Sloan Kettering Institute in New York. As to which came first, the malignancy or the disturbance of the chromosomes, these workers say without hesitation that the chromosomal irregularities precede the malignancy. Perhaps, they speculate, after the initial chromosome damage and the resulting instability, there is a long period of trial and error through many cell generations, the long latent period of malignancy, during which a collection of mutations is finally accumulated which allow the cells to escape from control and embark on the unregulated multiplication that is cancer. Uwen Winge, one of the early proponents of the theory of chromosome instability, felt that chromosome doublings were especially significant. Is it coincidence, then, that benzene hexachloride and its relative lindane are known through repeated observations to double the chromosomes in experimental plants, and that these same chemicals have been implicated in many well-documented cases of fatal anemias? And what of the many other pesticides that interfere with cell division, break chromosomes, cause mutations? It is easy to see why leukemia should be one of the most common diseases to result from exposure to radiation or to chemicals that imitate radiation. The principal targets of physical or chemical mutagenic agents are cells that are undergoing especially active division. This includes various tissues, but most importantly those engaged in the production of blood. The bone marrow is the chief producer of red blood cells throughout life, sending some 10 million new cells per second into the bloodstream of man. White corpuscles are formed in the lymph glands and in some of the marrow cells at a variable, but still prodigious rate. Certain chemicals, again reminding us of radiation products like strontium-90, have a peculiar affinity for the bone marrow. Benzene, a frequent constituent of insecticidal solvents, lodges in the marrow and remains deposited there for periods known to be as long as 20 months. Benzene itself has been recognized in medical literature for many years as a cause of leukemia. The rapidly growing tissues of a child would also afford conditions most suitable for the development of malignant cells. Sir McFarlane Burnet has pointed out that not only is leukemia increasing throughout the world, but it has become most common in the 3 to 4 year age bracket, an age incidence shown by no other disease. According to this authority, the peak between 3 and 4 years of age can hardly have any other interpretation than the exposure of the young organism to a mutagenic stimulus around the time of birth. Another mutagen known to produce cancer is urethane. When pregnant mice are treated with this chemical, not only do they develop cancer of the lung, but their young do also. The only exposure of the infant mice to urethane was prenatal in these experiments, proving that the chemical must have passed through the placenta. In human populations exposed to urethane or related chemicals, there is a possibility that tumors will develop in infants through prenatal exposure, as Dr. Huper has warned. Urethane, as a carbamate, is chemically related to the herbicides IPC and CIPC. Despite the warnings of cancer experts, carbamates are now widely used not only in insecticides, weed killers, and fungicides, but also in a variety of products including plasticizers, medicines, clothing, and insulating materials.
This ends Disc 7.